Today I wanted to talk about youthful crime, or sometimes called juvenile delinquency, although that is really a pejorative term. So I like to use the term youthful misconduct or youth crime. And it's really it's a very important issue, because essentially the crime problem is the problem of youthful crime. The period of the most serious crime rates are in the age groups 15 to 18. And this has probably always been true. Societies, as long as we know, I mean, if you think back about Socrates being put on trial and killed or executed for stirring up the youth of Athens, it's always been a concern. The generational conflict seems to have plagued all societies at all times, some more and some less. The reason I titled today's talk Youth Crime and Social Disunity is because I think modern youth crime is a sign of social disintegration. And if you think of integration and disintegration in terms of the parts of a society fitting together, and you look at primitive societies, and I don't know whether you've ever had this thought before, but when you ask, for example, what is the religion of the Navajos? Or to use American Indian tribes, or the religion of some African tribe. And it's unspecifiable. You cannot separate the religion from the rest of the culture. Their religion is the way they live their lives. Their religion is being a Navajo, or being a Hopi, or something like that. And their family life, their religious life, their economic life, it all fits together in an integrated whole. And you can't, it's like a bag full of fish hooks. You try to pull one out at a time, you can't do it. I mean, you pull the whole thing out. So likewise, you can't separate those parts of those societies. Now you look at modern society and you see how disintegrated or segregated the parts of our lives are. We can be of one religion of various types. We can have different family lifestyles. We can have all of these differentnesses, but be called one society. And so we can ask questions like, what is the religion of that society? And it may have a similar economy to another society, but have a completely different religion. Not completely different, but a lot different. And then also, likewise, you think of bringing up youth, and the point at which the youth is indoctrinated with the society's culture and the rituals that the youth goes through. For example, when Jesus goes to the temple at the age of 12, this seems to be the age where there's puberty rites in these tribes, where the child is infused with the culture and learns about it and what it is to be a member, an adult member of that culture. We don't have anything comparable in our society, because we don't really know what to give those children, you know, in terms of an idea of what our culture is, to indoctrinate them with our values. There's too much disintegration in the society. And the reason I titled the talk Youth Crime and Social Disunity is because I think youth crime is a result of this, a result of this segregation of youth from the rest of society. Generational conflict is inevitable in all societies, as I said, for a couple reasons. One, because of social change that takes place, and there's going to be more social generational conflict the greater the degree of social change. The generations will be out of whack, so to speak, in terms of their values. Likewise, comparable to social change is mobility. So we'll find greater generational conflict among immigrant cultures. When people move from one area to another area, the old culture that they left is out of step with the culture that the children are learning as they grow up. And so parent-youth conflict's going to be greater in those circumstances. Likewise, movement from rural to urban areas. There's typical rural ways of living that are not easily transferred to the city. I've really experienced that up here at Holden with my kids, where I live in a city, but up here, I don't care what they're doing. You know, I don't care where they are. I know they're okay. You know, I know other people are probably taking care of them, or other kids. You know, there's people watching them. They're not going to go, they can't get in too much trouble. Whereas in the city, I'm always concerned about where they are. I have to know where they are at each time. You know, like if they don't come right home from school, where are they? You know? And then when they do come home, I said, I told you, you're supposed to call me and tell me where you are, you know? So you have to learn a whole new way of life moving from a rural area to the city in terms of taking care of children. That's why there's so much crime, such a high crime rate among people, first generation movement to the city from rural areas. Also in revolutionary epochs, there's going to be great amounts of generational conflict. And then one of the things that we faced in modern technological societies that again contributes to this generational conflict is the increasing duration of family life. What I mean is that children are expected to be youth for longer and longer periods of time. At what age did your parents get their first job, or my grandparents take on an economic role in the family? You see, farm families, this is very clear. The child knows and takes part in the economic life of the family at a very early age. 100 years ago, and even maybe 50 years ago, it was very likely that kids were farmed out to other relatives. You know, one relative, a daughter would go and live with an aunt and an uncle here, and a son go. One of my roommates in college, 1 year, his family was from North Dakota, and part of the family was still on the farm back there. And he would go back there every summer and work on the farm. You know, here I was from the city. You know, what did I look forward to in the summertime? Getting in trouble, you know, or scrounging for something to do, you know, looking for a job. Well, you see, the length of time of dependence of children has increased. At what age does a child or a youth take up a formal economic role? It used to be 13. You know, if you look at these older cultures that don't have adolescence, you know, like Jesus goes to the temple at 12 and becomes an adult. Well, now we have adolescence or youth. You know, and you see how the age gradations in our society are increasing. It used to be like child, youth, and adult, maybe something like that, elderly. And now it's like preteen, teen, young adult, post-young adult teen, early middle age. You know, we've got all of these age gradations now that we didn't have before. And they're tied to the different stages in life that have occurred with the development of modern technologically based society. So what do we do with kids? Where they used to go to work, now they don't. They stay around and they stay around. At what age did you take up, you know, your formal role in your life, your economic role in your life? You may not even be into it yet. You may be 30. You know, I look at my students, they graduate from college, then they do something, they go to graduate school, they take a job here, and then they leave that job, they do something else, and they search and search and search. And so we've got all that time of dependency and the lack of strong commitment to the society. Well, you see how that's going to increase this generational conflict and the problems of youth. Last night at Vespers, for those of you who were there, I thought, gee, that was a really interesting precursor to today's session. What did you think of that? Did you have any? I didn't really know what to think of it too much. Yeah.
It was pretty open-ended, didn't it?
Right, it sure did. And, you know, it's this idea of youth or adolescence is this time of search, this sort of free time that we have. But, you know, sociologists noticed maybe 20 years ago now that adolescence was disappearing. But this period of searching around, this period where it's a protected period, you know, where children are shielded from reality. Well, that hardly exists anymore. It's moving now from childhood into some prolonged period that really doesn't have a designated end. What I mean is that there's a youth culture that's emerged in our society, and children are socialized into that youth culture because part of the peer group. It's not even necessary to leave it anymore. I mean, you can have elderly youthful people. You know, you can have old age hippies. you know, that it's a kind of lifestyle that exists throughout the society now. Someone has said that adolescence has disappeared because the entire society has become adolescentized. And, you know, look at dress and fads and fashions that emerge from youth and envelop the whole society, and how we're always changing, ready to change. We're never satisfied with our existence as it is. That's what adolescence used to be, the search for a stable adult identity. Well, where is the stable adult identity? It's really hard to come by these days. Lots of times there's a distinction made between two types of delinquency. It has to do with the degree of seriousness. There's the kind of delinquency that maybe all kids get involved in to one extent or another. When I teach a class in juvenile delinquency, I hand out a list of crimes to the class, and I say, okay, check the ones that you've done. Most of us have, there's a lot of youth crimes that aren't crimes for adults. You know, they're called age status offenses, because if youth do them, they're crimes. If adults do them, they're not. This gives a great opportunity for youth to experiment and to live a life of excitement and daring do, you know, to try to do these things without getting caught. But there's, you know, petty thievery, fighting. It's very difficult to get through youth or adolescence without being involved to some extent in law-violating behavior. But then on the other hand, there's this other type, and what we consider to be serious, much more serious delinquency, having to do with serious crimes of property, robbery, murder, rape, things like that. But what I wanted to try to show you today is that these are only differences in terms of gradation. They aren't essentially different. In other words, they're all part of the same whole. It has to do with the degree to which one takes up that ideology of delinquency. And delinquency is an ideology. And it's very common, and it's been in our society for quite a long time. And all youth, and I use that term advisedly, maybe 99.9%, maybe not all, but are involved in it to one degree or another, because it serves the function to allow them to make the passage from childhood into adulthood. And that's why we don't stamp it out. And that's also why we may keep it around to look to youth for experimentation as our culture changes. And we look to the younger generation then for direction. And so we allow this kind of juvenile misconduct to go on to some degree. Just as one example, the pop music. Maybe you're acquainted with some of these rallies where kids bring their records in and they burn them or throw them on a big pile and smash them because rock and roll is evil. You know, there's a tendency for parents, if you are a parent, it's really discouraging to listen to the lyrics of those songs. It's true. But, you know, because kids listen to those songs, does that mean they feel those things themselves, or that they do those things or want to do those things? You know, that's not entirely true, but they're obviously participating in part of that ideology.
Isn't one of the more direct effects upon the youth through some of the television rock, hard rock music that comes with MTV?
MTV. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up.
A couple of weeks ago in the Sunday paper in Seattle, we had the large amount of violence that is depicted in the stuff. Weird kind of violence. And primarily
right.
Violence toward women that comes with the music is just it can have a very good effect upon the community.
Yeah, it can't be good. One wonders what it is. I remember when I was a kid, I was just after the generation that discovered rock and roll, and it was widely condemned. You know, but now you look back at that music and it's so innocent and pure. One wonders where it's going, because, you know, we'll, you know, 20, 30 years now, we look back at this music that we're considering so vile now as being innocent. Well, I hope not.
To me, it seems like in putting so much emphasis on the violence of television and the suggestions that you get through in TV and some of the other things, I almost wonder if it's an adult's way of putting the blame on something else. Because I remember as a child, I mean, we watched Roy Rogers and all kinds of Wild West shows where they were again, bang, the guy dropped over dead. There was a lot of violence in a different way on television. And yet I don't feel that I have any, my whole family watched those shows, and yet the violence really was not as much of an influence on me as what I saw my parents, my grandparents, and my adult people around me doing. That's where I feel like I picked up my values. And I'm wondering a lot when there's so much about all the things the kids are seeing on television and the things going on, if that is really the major influence on them, or if it's the adults around them that are making, you know, the real live people. I think they can, I don't know, I've always felt that there's, youth have a real good capability of distinguishing between what's on TV, what's in the cartoons, what's...
Yeah,
what
segregating
what
they're
really
seeing and what they feel.
Is happening around them in real human relations.
I would agree with you because I studied family systems theory, and a child is a product of the socialized importance of his family, his or her family. And I think that if parents blame TV or films, that's a way of being irresponsible. And all behavior is goal directed. A child gets something out of misbehavior, and obviously it's rewarded by the system that they're brought up in. So I think it's a way of being responsible.
I don't think that there's near as much influence as some people feel.
I don't think it's helpful, but I don't think that it's highly influential.
George, before you get off of this topic of youth and how youth has expanded, you know, adolescence is now going on up into the 20s and so on, and these kids get into this mischief or that mischief. Is that possibly our way of the rites of passage, you know, the puberty tests?
I think it is to some extent.
You know, some of them will make it and some of them don't. Mm-hmm. Just like some of them never went out and killed their bear. They had to come back to camp and be in shame.
I think there's some truth to that. You think of some of these rituals, for example, our culture is so heavily involved in alcohol usage, and so early adulthood is this period of experimenting with alcohol, and lots of kids run into trees and don't make it, and those that do learn how to drive while they're drunk, and then they become, you know, carries them through till their metabolism changes in middle age, and then they start getting in trouble again now and have to learn how to be middle age drinkers. I think there's some truth to that. I really do. Juvenile delinquency was discovered almost coterminous with the discovery of adolescence. The first textbook on adolescence comes out almost exactly the same time as the first textbook on juvenile delinquency. And it's around just after 1900, right after the turn of the century. And they call it, you know, the discovery of adolescence or the discovery of juvenile crime. And the social changes that, of course, have taken place to produce this were the changes that shoved youth out of the economy and gave them no responsible place in the society in which they could contribute, in which they could be independent contributors to the society, and put them in a purely dependent position. Adolescence then was a middle class phenomenon, in a sense that it was a way, well, the middle class now, they're going to give their child this period of protection where they can sort of get their act together and go to, you know, colleges, especially our Lutheran colleges, not especially, but most sectarian colleges would be good examples of this, a place to send your children where they're protected and insulated from the evils of the world. And then when they become adults, they can move out from there. For the working class, of course, this was never true. They were the delinquents. They didn't have these places to go. And so the discovery of juvenile delinquency was, in a sense, a class phenomenon, a social class phenomenon. And the development of juvenile courts, the idea that maybe we should treat youth differently in law and justice than we do adults. And the court had this ethic of called in loco parentis, where the court took over the role of the parents and tried to decide what was best for the kid, rather than just sending him to prison. But that was never true, and it was never realized, and it never could be realized. There's no way that a justice system that's downtown in a building that a person comes to for an appointment can take the place of a family in terms of deciding what's in the best interest of the child or in terms of dispositions. What they did with the youth that would substitute for a nice family life. So here's this group of youth that are sort of running around the streets, and then, you know, the academics come in and say, well, what are we going to do about it? And so there's mostly a psychoanalytic perspective in trying to deal with emotional growth. That's where we can trace back this delinquency ideology that has several variations. And books have been written tracing the progress of these ideologies through the decades up to this time. And you remember, think about this, the terms that they refer to, the society or journalists refer to, that they call a youth generation from time to time. In the 1920s, they call them one thing, you know, flaming youth or the lost generation. And then I remember in the 50s, they called them crazy teenagers. Remember the movies like Rebel Without a Cause and West Side Story? In the 60s, that's reinterpreted as sort of a political bent, that youth and youthful misconduct has some kind of political message. In the 70s, the silent generation, in the 80s, you know, which is a little different. In the 80s, I don't know what. But if I were to put a fourfold box on a chalkboard, you know, a square with four parts, and as you know, showing a two variables in a dichotomous relationship, so that when they're paired up, you get four different parts. And on one side, you put chronological age, youth or older, or adult, and on the other axis, whether the person embraces youth culture or not, yes or no. Then you see you get four combinations. You get youth who are involved in youth culture, you get older people who are involved in youth culture, and then on the lower lower boxes, you have younger people who are not involved in youth culture. And we, you know, maybe you were like this, and we all know people like this that maybe skipped their youthful period and were sort of junior adults from as long ago as you can remember them, you know, following whatever authorities said and being sort of like super parents to other kids. And then you have what would be the fourth one? Older people who are older in their cultural traits. As I said, there's tracing back this youth culture, one finds three distinct branches that go back in time. One of these branches is the delinquent culture. Another one is the bohemian culture. And a third one is a political radical culture. And these are three types of stances toward life that youth can find themselves, that are available to youth, that they can fall into, that they can take up, that are critical stances toward adult society, that are separate from and critical of stable adult existence. I brought a copy of a song. I wanted to read the lyrics to you. one of my favorite songs. Rock and roll, the content may not be as important as the form. You know, the loud music and the energy that's involved in the music is maybe where it's at, you know, and the lyrics aren't that important. So when you read the lyrics, this has always been a joke. I remember Steve Allen did this on television a long, long time ago. Take rock and roll songs and read the lyrics without the music, and they sound stupid. Like Bebop-a-Lula, things like that. So you probably don't get the indication of the feeling of this music by just reading the lyrics. But I wanted to do this because the song embraces so much of the themes of youth culture, of freedom, excitement, do it now, and not wanting to become an adult, not wanting to settle down, not wanting to take up a stable, mundane, routine existence. The society looks then at youth culture as something that is dangerous, because if it got loose and took over the society, there'd be social disorder. We couldn't function as a society. So it's going to be repressed to some extent at all times. But areas where that repression generally fails, where the weapons of that repression generally fail, are areas where adult authorities are lacking, where adult authorities themselves have trouble. This is especially in areas like ghettos and slums, and as I mentioned earlier, in immigrant situations or during periods of severe social change. Instruments of repression will also be weak in areas where the institutions of the repression themselves fail to relate to the children's needs. This is especially true in schools where children that have academic problems have trouble relating to the school. So a child looks at their school situation in terms of impending academic failure. And so where are they to get the status in their peer groups that they need? Well, you see, the delinquent or bohemian or radical ideologies present themselves as alternative systems of status that these youths can get into then and feel better about themselves in terms of their peer group, although the rest of us or adult society looks at them as severe problems. But here's a song. I really like this song because of the energy that's in it when you listen to it. But I can't portray that in the way that I read it, but it's a song by Bruce Springsteen called Born to Run. And you can see, listen to these lyrics, and you can see how kids that are in really stable, routine lives, middle class suburbs, this would appeal to them, you know, in terms of just being on a tangential basis, you know, they don't want to be totally involved in it, but it can give them a sense of excitement while they undergo or bear up with their routine. In the day we sweated out in the streets of a runaway American dream. At night we ride through mansions of glory and suicide machines. Sprung from cages out on Highway 9, chrome wheel, fuel injected, and stepping out over the line. Baby, this town rips your bones from your back. It's a death trap. It's a suicide rap. We gotta get out while we're young, cause tramps like us, baby, we were born to run. Wendy, let me in. I wanna be your friend. I want to guard your visions and dreams. Just wrap your legs around these velvet rims and strap your hands across my engines. Together we could break this trap. We'll run till we drop. Baby, we'll never go back. Will you walk with me out on the wire? Because, baby, I'm just a scared and lonely rider. But I got to know how it feels. I want to know if your love is wild. Girl, I want to know if love is real. Beyond the palace, hemi-powered drones scream down the boulevard. The girls comb their hair in rearview mirrors, and the boys try to look so hard. The amusement park rises bold and stark. Kids are huddled on the beach in a mist. I want to die with you out on the streets tonight in an everlasting kiss. The highway's jammed with broken heroes on a last chance power drive. Everybody's out on the run tonight, and there's no place left to hide. Together, Wendy, we can live with the sadness. I'll love you with all the madness of my soul. Someday, girl, I don't know when, we're going to get out to that place where we really want to go, and we'll walk in the sun. Till then, tramps like us, baby, we were born to run. It's really popular. It was very popular a few years ago, that tune.
He also writes the tongue-in-cheek, so.
Yeah, right. And, well, I think rock and roll writers have, in general, always done that. you know, writing to appeal to the younger group. Some of the characteristics of I was surprised when I was studying in graduate school, studying juvenile gangs. We tend to think of those gangs like in inner city gangs as contemporary to the times. But in eastern cities like Chicago and Boston and New York and so on, there's stable working class neighborhoods, Irish neighborhoods, for example, that can trace back membership in these gangs back to, you know, uncles and grandfathers, where they pass their jackets on down through the generations. In Chicago, the gangs are divided up into, you know, the women's auxiliary, the junior midgets, the juniors. You know, they have a whole social system going in these gangs. The rebelliousness of these traditions, especially the delinquency tradition, is pretty apparent. The search for excitement, thrills and kicks, the manufacture of excitement. If there's none around, you know, like, what are we going to do? Let's go make some excitement. Putting down material rewards that come by routine, the methodical methods of the straight world, the emphasis on aggression or physical prowess, honor, reputation, and so on. And one thing about drugs is that it seems to fulfill all these needs. That drugs present themselves as this dangerous thing that you play with, that you may get caught up in, and the procurement of these things, it's illegal. And so you're violating the law and the risk that's involved in the excitement. Kids in inner city ghettos that are heavily involved in drugs, drug addiction like heroin addiction, occupies their whole existence. It's a total, you know, talk about the routine of middle class life. At least most of the time people get to go home in the evenings. I mean, addicts, I mean, they're from morning until they go to bed, you know, they're involved in this lifestyle, you know, procuring and using, it takes up their entire existence. Student radicalism also goes back a long ways, and it's an ideology that's it rises up, becomes much more apparent from time to time, becomes a fad from time to time. It's an idealistic way of criticizing the society, looking at the society's basic values and seeing how the society falls short of those. This is something that adolescents are very involved in. They understand, they're taught in school about basic American values, and they look out and they don't see those values being promoted. They don't see them being exported in foreign policy. And so it's an easy way to criticize the society, and it's a stance that one can stand back and say, I don't like that society, I don't know if I want to be a part of that society. And then bohemianism takes on different names from time to time. Sometimes it's called, well, in the 50s they were beatniks, and it was part of the hippie generation in the 60s. This emphasis on artistic expression and withdrawal from the society, and a cynical point of view towards society, almost kind of a monasticism. Bohemians don't go out and recruit. You sort of have to prove yourself as being an alienated person from society. The way that you dress and the way that you speak, your speaking style, to become a part of that. Well, why don't we wipe it out? You know, why doesn't adult society completely repress it? The Soviet Union, of course, attempts to do something like that. They're not completely successful. They're going to be. I just noticed the other day there's a new socialistic interpretation of Levi's. They've lost the war, in other words. You know, this happens. This is another thing with social change. When social change or these cultural changes take place, in the 60s, you see the youth generation came out to dominate our society. And the reason it did was because we didn't have too much choice. In the 1960s, all of a sudden, there was a tremendous demographic change that took place. From the 1950s to the 1960s. In the 1960s, there were all of a sudden twice as many youth as there had been in the 1950s. And if you were around then, you remember how schools were overcrowded. They were building schools like crazy. There weren't enough facilities for kids. There weren't enough things for them to do. They were communicating and developing this cultural revolution. And there's nothing the society can do about it but pretty much go along with it. Well, that's what happens. And the leadership of a society sees these changes taking place. They try to repress them. It gets to a point where they realize that if they continue to repress, they're going to lose. There's going to be a revolution. So they give in and say, okay, you know, you can go on and do that as long as you acknowledge our leadership. Well, that's apparently what's happened with the Levi Revolution in the Soviet Union. Because they can't keep them out. So now they've reinterpreted Levi's as not being examples of bourgeois decadence, but actually stemming from the style of dress the working class wears, which is true. You know, so it's sort of a monument to working class existence. I think that that we don't wipe these things out because of problems of social change and because we don't have anything else for youth to do at this particular time. You can't repress this unless there's an alternative. And we really haven't dealt with this problem yet in our society. Like, what? How could we reintegrate youth into our society? We'd have to do it as basically economically, by giving youth economic roles in our society. There's plenty of opportunities for this, but we really haven't taken it up as a social problem and one we want to deal with yet. So in the meantime, we say, okay, you know, you can do your thing, just don't get it, let it get out of hand. And because the demographic changes that took place in the 60s, there's been a reversal, so that there's been a tremendous decline in the number of youth in society. There's been a 21% decline in the number of people under 18 years old in the last 10 years, that we find it much easier to control these things than we did in the past. Yes?
I have a question. When you're talking about setting up something, a lifestyle or whatever for the youth, if the adults actually took that on as a project, would the youth even accept it? I mean, isn't this the rebellion period, where they're not going to really want to do anything that's
well to do with. And that's, you know, what I'm talking about is reducing the gap between adult life and between youths and adults.
In other words, accepting a younger person as more of an adult status?
No. What I mean is that instead of segregating youth off from society and schools, this is what promotes youth culture, of course, is primarily the segregation. That our answer to what are we going to do with kids now that they're not working anymore, back in the late 1800s, was to expand schools. So if you look at the days that youth spend in schools, it's a steady increase. Now there's, of course, year-round schools. Let's talk about that. That's our alternative. But what happens is when people are segregated, whether they're ethnically or racially segregated or age segregated, they start developing critical attitudes toward the other group. And nasty rumors start about how dirty and unclean these other people are. And the only way you can break that down is to reintegrate. See, so what it would mean would be a revolution in the style of schooling. And I don't really mean a revolution, but just a reorganization. So that maybe meaningful work becomes a part of education. And I know, you know, youth want to work. They want to feel responsible. They want some responsibility. My kids are always trying to take over my tasks. And I say, no, you don't know how to do it. I don't want you to cook dinner. I won't be able to eat it. They say, well, that's why we want to take it over. We can't eat what you cook. they're starving, you know, to be meaningful, to have a meaningful existence in our society, one that's recognized. But we increasingly, you know, we say no. You know, wait. And so they get into their peer groups.
and the segregation of education, for instance. The insulation from what adults do. Well, what's happening with serious delinquency? First, I wanted to mention the response. We're becoming, the society in general, is becoming much more tougher with youth, with serious delinquency. The state of Washington, I think, was the first state to do away with its juvenile courts. And almost every state has made it much easier to deal with young adults or with juveniles in adult courts in recent years. California is debating a law that would allow kids to be locked up for 90 days without a hearing, just for normal status offenses, curfew violations, drinking underage, those kinds of things. The end of adolescence, in other words, also means that we're less willing to treat children within this period as a special group. Yes?
Is this tendency not to treat in the adolescence differently, is that associated with, say, frontier states? For example, I was noticing and explaining to a boy that I was traveling with to a lake near here that the wilderness doesn't give you a second chance. If you leave something at a campsite and walk away from it, the wilderness doesn't call you back like a parent and say, hey, did you forget something? You can pick that up before you leave. And I got the feeling that maybe the frontier makes you feel that we don't need to pamper people in a different way. To the wilderness, you're no different whether you're an adult or a senior or an adult.
Yeah. No, that's true. That's very true. These programs, maybe you hear about it from time to time, that are so successful with serious delinquents, like Outward Bound, be an example. Or there's another one called Vision Quest, or the Quest, I don't know if you've heard of that one, but it's very popular. It's where they take kids out on a wagon train trip across the wilderness. There's programs where they teach kids mountain climbing, and then they go out to some peak and climb a mountain. This seems, why is this so successful in turning these kids' lives around?
Because they learn to work with the coordination, cooperation, relationships, support groups.
How can we emulate that in our society without, you know, waiting for a kid to get it to be a serious delinquent and then send them off into the wilderness?
Well, I think that those programs too, they're in a short-term effect. If there's no follow-up with that, then the effect is real, real short-term. Something has to change within society and within the family system if the child finds himself. Or I've worked with juvenile delinquents for 4 years, and I know what it's like to fix a kid and send him back home, and within a year, you know, you have someone in adult court now that is a juvenile court.
Right.
So I don't know that. I guess they have a short-term success. I don't think there's a whole lot of fear.
Well, I don't know. You know, I think they work much better than normal institutional programs for longer periods of time. You know, in terms of what usually happens, see, the best cure to delinquency is getting to be, you know, 21 years old. I mean, most delinquents stop being delinquents when they get, you know, a little older. And I think that what a lot of these programs are doing are giving kids senses of accomplishment, that they can do something. They can start out to do something with a goal that they never thought they could do and they can accomplish it. And that the hope is that maybe they can transfer this to other areas of their life too.
This idea of learning to work together, the Boy Scout program is supposed to have that. I was on a scout committee in the church, and there was at one of the committee meetings, they wanted, there was a new person there, they didn't want him to join the troop because he swore. So here's somebody who needs that training, and he isn't being allowed in because he doesn't meet the criteria. My son wanted to get into an explorer group when he was a teenager with long hair, run by the Dallas Police Department. They told him he couldn't come back unless he cut his hair. I was shocked, you know. How you could have changed anybody under those circumstances?
Yeah. That was another thing I didn't even talk about, was also around 1900 with the discovery of delinquency in adolescence. That's when the beginnings of Boy Scouts and all of these other programs are traced back to, right about that time. That there's these organizations run by adults to try to control or somewhat administer to the needs and monitor the behavior of youth. Churches and involvement in church is an insulation against delinquency. There's no doubt about that. So, but where you find these kinds of organizations weak, you don't find strong Boy Scout troops in the slums, you know, or churches that are family oriented in the slums. So I've lived in two different towns that claim that there's more churches per capita in this city than any other city in the United States. And you know, it was funny, when I moved to Oakland, California, and drove around the slums and ghettos there, there's at least three churches on every block. There's got to be more churches in the slums than any other area, you know, any other city. But they don't make it in the phone book. And a lot of them only last about 3 or 4 weeks until the minister's money runs out. But studies do show, you know, that involvement in church activities is, to some degree, an insulation against falling into the delinquent ideology. Yes.
When you talk about making schools so that children could feel more part of the society, maybe earning part of the economic system, do you have any examples of how?
Well, isn't this being done to some extent? Is there anybody here that's involved with high schools? I know that when I went through high school, you had to be there all day, you know, or else you were a truant. But now I notice the kids go to high school, they only have to be there about half the time.
Especially in senior year. Right. I think it comes down from college. If they get their credits and have maybe one or two credits to do the last semester, they can go to class one period, and then they get an outside job working at the local, you know, store, just selling, or the girls who are, or the young men who are in typing classes go out and get a part-time job at the local offices one year or other. And they earn a little bit. And sometimes, yes, they do earn a little bit, because I had one fella who did yard work for me. And I had to fill out a little statement that he did well, his attitude was good, that kind of thing.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask about the connection between alcohol abuse and juvenile delinquency in a consistent chronic stage. Isn't an awful lot of this, a very high percentage of juvenile delinquency, connected with either alcohol abuse by themselves or they come from an alcoholic family?
Serious delinquency is related to, and serious crime in general is related to alcohol abuse.
Yeah.
It's alcohol, of course, is the all-American drug. The best commercials on television are beer commercials. My kids love to watch. They're fun to watch. You know. The taste great against the white, you know, the lust feelings. You know. My kid's 11 years, he craves beer already. You know. He always wants to. But why is it the all-American drug? You know, it's why is something like marijuana the all anti-American drug? And but predominates in other, like some third world countries. A lot of people tie it to the aggressive nature of American society, especially tied up with business ethics and the importance of alcohol to doing business. It allows people to be aggressive and sociable, where they and to put down their inhibitions against that. And so what alcohol does is repress inhibitions against violence. And people can be more violent under the influence of alcohol. They have less inhibitions against that. And this, of course, then goes into aggressive crimes, too. And so much aggressive, violent crimes take place under the influence of alcohol.
We've had a women's shelter at the center. Kind of traced over a 6-month period that 90% of all abuse, physical and white abuse or child abuse, has its connections with alcohol.
I don't.
Very, very. And this happens also in the Vatican and Shelter that we began to see that same kind of statistics are showing. And it seems to me that when we, as a society, turn it around rather than existing as a nation of pushers and drug pushers, that we turn around and to say to the young people of our country that this is dangerous for you, and this has to happen.
I think that goes back to the other thing. We can't just say it, we have to live it.
That's
the
right.
Part that's really,
as adults,
you know, we can sit
live.
There and have a glass of wine with dinner and say, it's okay, I'm an adult, but you guys really shouldn't be having it. And that just a double standard and just pick up on that.
And a glass of wine with dinner is a different thing than pushing a beer ad on television.
Right.
When wine is consumed in a meal, as for instance with many Jewish communities and Jewish families, the rate of alcoholism is less than 1%.
Right, but an adult thinks nothing of going to a New Year's Eve party or going out to the
right.
to a local tavern, or, you know, it's socially totally acceptable.
Sure.
And I think that
sure.
to tell youth that this is impossible, you really shouldn't be doing this, it's going to ruin your life, but I can do it because I'm older, it's really...
Well, what we have to do, one of the things, that what you're getting at is that some cultures like Jewish culture, Italian culture, and so on, are long-standing German culture, two long-standing drinking cultures that have norms that they teach their kids about when it's appropriate to drink and the time and place. And but cultures that don't have these norms, then the people that drink are sort of cut loose. Or in families that have alcohol abuse, this becomes a standard. I've read that the highest rates of alcoholism are among among people who drink in abstaining cultures, like Mormons
and when they drink,
right.
When they drink alcohol. I think it's important to educate young people that their body physiologically is not able to deal with alcohol. And when the body becomes 21 years of age, your liver, your central nervous system, the whole physiological makeup of the individual is such that you can handle alcohol and not become addictive. And it will, but that's true. Native American and certain cultural backgrounds and so forth. But basically, the young body in its adolescent and the teenage stage, and the elderly body, the body that's over 60, those bodies are very similar. They become, within 6 months, a child, a teenager, can become a full-blown alcoholic.
A teenage alcoholic.
That's how fast it can happen, and it's a terrible tragedy. And then, of course, the all-consuming passion, the all-consuming life of that individual is to have alcohol, to have something that takes away the pain.
Yeah, but I had a comment when we were discussing drugs and how they really don't help you. They, you know, the main thing to do is they have no help. But I was reminded of the fact that over here I go and get coffee because it helps me. And I was reminded of this by a young boy.
Yeah.
Well, there's an ad on television now, the Coffee Institute or something like that. The Achievers.
The Coffee Achievers.
You know, the beer ones are, you know, like you can't have a good time without beer.
Yeah.
You know, so it always shows everybody having a good time. And then the Achievers are the people, I guess, that are back there, you know, making money and stuff like that and getting a education. They're drinking coffee like crazy.
Coffee is a drug, though, but it acts in the body in a completely different way than alcohol is a drug does. Or as nicotine is a drug does. And so that it's very important to categorize drugs and how they act in our body, in our physical and our physiological universe.
Is that our witness, though?
Well, I wanted to say one thing also about that, and that's that when people use drugs, if the drug is, whether it's alcohol, tobacco, or these common drugs, they're going to mean different things at different periods of their use. In other words, the reason kids start drinking alcohol is probably because they have a good time, or because it drives their parents up the wall, you know, or, you know, because they have this adult-child conflict, because they want to feel like adults, they want to, you know, all of these things that are involved. When they're 35, 40 years old, and they're alcoholics, it means something different to them. And it's also with tobacco. Almost everybody starts smoking tobacco, who is a smoker during adolescence. And it means something different. Smoking a pack a day in adolescence in high school means something different than when you're 50 years old and you're still smoking. It's a different thing. And so what we have to attack is not just the drug itself, but the meanings that it has to people that are using it. And parents find themselves in a situation where their children are drinking a lot, where they're teenage alcoholics, and they find themselves in this conflict with their children, and they find themselves, you know, always being upset, and the child really drives them off the wall by this. You have to take on that meaning, not just that they're addicted to the drug, but deal with the meaning that that has to them. And also with tobacco, I love it too. Well, we better stop here. We didn't get to recidivism or rehabilitation or those things.